jurisdiction from QCD background. So in particular, we were interested in looking at the regime where some of the new particles you're producing are boosted, and that helps you because you can use jet substructure techniques. So it's been a little while since the last talk that people talked about jet substructures. So if you know, I'll go over some details. If there are things you don't understand, just stop me and let me know.
It's okay. The last one was by Heather, and Jim is nice.
So why are we thinking about these kinds of event topologies? Well, we first expect new physics to show up in the strong sector because the production cross-sections are so large. And so you can produce particles that are several hundreds of GeV, even TeV, and potentially observe their decays at the LHC. Now, as I mentioned, there's a lot of QCD background associated with final states that are just consisting of jets. And so in particular, experiments tend to focus on other handles that you can do to cut down the background. So for instance, events where you have missing energy, leptons, photons, this sort of thing. And there, the dominant background is TOPS, but it's at least it's much smaller than what you get just from multi-jet production. And what's nice is that you can generally get these kinds of signatures in new physics. So for instance, in supersymmetry, you can or other things where you have some kind of parity, you can get a stable neutral particle at the bottom of your new spectrum that can be dark matter, and this generally gives you missing energy in your detector. Also, if something is connected to the hierarchy problem, we generally expect it to couple to TOPS, which are things that connect most strongly to the Higgs, so you can also get leptons and missing energy through that. But because these things are so visible at the LHC, the bounds are starting to get quite strong. So I'm not going to go over them in much detail, but basically, we're starting to see Schwarz Galilei bounds in the TeV range, such that these particles have to be really quite a bit above the weak scale or the Higgs mass. The stop and spot-on bounds are somewhat lighter, and there is in particular a window right around the top mass where you can have stops, but nowadays, as the sort of heavier stops and spot-on bounds get higher, you need to have some kind of a weird spectrum where you have some very light stops and spot-ons and not a whole lot else in between. So a lot of people say, okay, well, maybe supersymmetry is dead or there's not new physics beyond the standard model. However, if we look at all hadronic final states, then none of these constraints matter anymore. And so we were interested in seeing just how well that you could do in these kinds of final states. So as a particular benchmark, we chose a simplified model where you have a new color octet fermion, which in SUSE would be a Galilei, and it decays through an R-parity violating coupling to three quarks. So in this particular example, you have a Galilei decaying through an off-shell Schwark into three quarks. Really what we're doing could be extended to other similar topologies. They don't have to be connected to supersymmetry. So the techniques are somewhat general, but we just wanted something concrete to latch on to. And in this particular example, because the Galilei is decaying to three jets, you can hope to reconstruct properties of the Galilei if you can pick out those jets and look at their kinematic properties. Now, if you just have the six-jet event, it's hard to figure out which jets you should combine together. So we're looking at the regime where the Galileos are boosted. When the Galileos are boosted, even moderately, then their decay products tend to be collimated. And so what you can do is instead of looking for six jets, try to look for two fat jets, which sort of encompass each fat jet encompassing the decay products of a single Galileo. And you can study the properties of that fat jet to extract the properties of the Galileo. And over the past 5 or 10 years, there's been a large number of jet substructure techniques that have been developed for precisely this scenario. Now, boosted object tagging is conventionally used when the resonances that produce multiple jets or whatever it is that you're using your fat jet analysis for are produced in a decay chain. So you produce some very heavy particles that are almost at rest. They then decay to some intermediate particles, which are at some intermediate mass scale and therefore very energetic. And then those decay into collimated multi-jet final states. So for instance, you can produce a Z prime at the LHC. The Z prime decays into two tops. If the Z prime has a mass of, say, TeV, then those tops are going to have energy much larger than their mass. They're going to be highly boosted. Then those tops decay into quarks, and you end up with these two fat jets, one each reconstructing a top quark. What we look at in this is a different scenario, which is that even if you're not producing the hadronic resonances in your intermediate state in a cascade decay, but rather that you're just producing it, there's always going to be some fraction of them that are energetic and therefore boosted. Now, you're losing in some way because the cross-section for the boosted fraction is going to go down relative to what you had before. But if by looking at the boosted regime, you have more handles with which to distinguish the signal from the background, then you might end up winning in the end, such that you kill your signal, but you kill your background even more. And so by looking at using aggressive substructure cuts, you can get high purity samples. So maybe you only have a few events left over, but they, you know, you're pretty sure that what you're seeing is signal. The other thing that's nice about this is that you can actually look for the resonance of the Gleaner decay through the jet mass for the jet that's reconstructing the Gluino. So even if you know your overall S over B signal to background is not particularly large, you can see a bump in your spectrum. So you can do a shape analysis. And at the very least, this kind of approach is completely complementary to what the experiments are currently looking at. And so therefore, the systematic error should be uncorrelated. It serves as a good check, particularly if at some point we actually do see evidence of new physics. A lot of the existing searches might not be able to tell us, say, what the mass of that new physics is. And so these kinds of searches can come in and fill in those gaps. So the other thing that we looked at is this idea of color flow, about the fact that we're producing these states that have color charge and that there are color connections between the final state particles leading to specific radiation patterns associated with the final state. And I'll go into a little bit more detail about how exactly we can use this. We see that particularly in highly boosted samples, you can use the fact that if you have a boosted resonance, it reconstructs a particularly colored, an object of a particular color charge, which may be different from the background, and therefore allow you even better discrimination than you might otherwise have. So to begin with, I'll say just a few words about Gluinos in our parity-violating models. Again, we're not so concerned with the specifics of the model, but it's helpful to at least motivate why we're picking this one. Then I'll give an overview of existing searches for this topology, about how the bounds have gotten really good over the past few years that the experiments are doing. They've increased by a factor of 4 or 5 over what they were before. And then I'll talk about what the boosted Gluinos will look like, what kinds of jet substructure variables we're going to be interested in, and then some of these color flow ideas. And then we do all of this in a Monte Carlo study to see that it's actually feasible that you can use these techniques and what the mass reach for Gluinos that we can achieve is. So our parity is a symmetry that is usually added to supersymmetric theories to remove unwanted operators, where if you just have the general MSSM, you have all kinds of baryon and lepton violating interactions that are in conflict with observed experiments. So an easy way to get out of this is to impose this symmetry that completely wipes out all of the operators that you don't want. And generally what this results in is, because it's a parity, you have some odd particles, you have some even particles, and if you if the parity is exactly conserved, then the odd particles can never decay because you always have an odd particle having to decay into an even and then another odd particle. So this is what gives you the jet splits missing energy that the searches in colliders are becoming so constrained. So an easy way to do this is to say, well, if the main motivation was actually to get rid of the dangerous baryon and lepton number violating interactions, then maybe our parity is going too far. It's easier to take a step back and actually identify what are the operators that we don't want to show up in our theory, and then don't allow those in your theory, and then do allow the operators that can be allowed. There's not necessarily a nice symmetry reason for this, but at least it's consistent with experimental observations. So. In particular, and in this particular case, you can, by imposing a U1 symmetry, get out of these other operators. But it turns out that a lot of the most dangerous measurements, so for instance, constraints from proton decay, neutrino masses, et cetera. So proton decay requires both baryon violation and lepton violation. Neutrino masses obviously come about through lepton violation. So if we preserve lepton number and allow baryon violation, then it turns out that there's this one extra operator that we can add to our theory, which is a UDD type operator. And it turns out the constraints on this aren't too bad, particularly depending on what the flavor indices are. There's a lot of debate at the moment about what the constraints on these things are, because they have to be extracted from typically nuclear measurements, that there are a lot of uncertainties associated with the hadronic matrix elements and so forth. So I'll mention in a minute what some of these constraints are, but in principle, this is allowed, and these couplings can be quite large, as opposed to the other R-parity violating operators where the couplings have to be small. That's right, so you have to go through, so you can get nucleon, antinucleon oscillations, so you typically have to go through strange squarks. there's usually a mixing between a left and right-handed strange score. So if you expect that the mixing is proportional to its Yukawa coupling, then those go away. Like I said, depending on which reference you look at, so there's this big R parity violating review, and they basically say that constraints on the UDS operator could be anywhere between 10 to the minus 6 and 1, depending on who you believe, what uncertainties you accept. So like, for instance, some people think that the nucleon, any nucleon oscillation doesn't actually lead to a bound. I don't quite understand their argument.
That doesn't depend on where the squarks
are? It does depend on where the squarks are. I'm talking about if you have squarks at the few TeV scale. Then, so I mean, if you decouple the squarks, then yeah.
Yeah, but decouple the first generation, so you don't want them anyway, you just keep the circuit.
Yeah, so you could do that in principle. Yeah. Now the one thing is that if you have decays going through higher generations, then suddenly you're introducing Bs and tops into your final state, and that generally makes it easier to find. So a lot of these natural SUSY models where you have a light third generation with R parity violation, the constraints are starting to get somewhat strong on those. So in this model, you can have a squark decaying into two quarks. You can also have a gluino decaying into three quarks, either through an on-shell intermediary squark or an off-shell squark. The on-shell intermediary squark only makes life easier for you because you have some extra resonance to reconstruct. So we're going to generally consider the case where you have an off-shell squark. So like I said, if these couplings involve the third generation, there are additional bounds that come from tops that's showing up in your final state or B tags. And so there are a few papers that have been looking at this scenario. So we focus on the other allowed couplings, which are the 1-2-1 and 2-1-2 couplings. And in these cases, the squarks and gluinos basically decay into light flavor quarks. And so you're really left with a very big irreducible QCD multijet background, just in principle. So like I was saying, you have these bounds from nucleon and antinucleon oscillation. There are also these double nucleon decays where you can have two protons decaying to two kaons, for instance. Once again, this is really dependent on a lot of different factors and depending. So this is assuming, let's say, a strange squark of a mass 3 TeV. Then the bounds can apparently range from 10 to the minus 6 to 1. I don't know enough about nuclear physics to really be able to comment on who to trust. But the moral is that this coupling could be very small or it could be somewhat big. And there's basically a no bound on the 2-1-2 coupling. So there is some very much. Mm-hmm. So I think it can be both. So if you really believe if you believe one of the estimates for the nucleon mixing such that you get a 10 to the minus 6, but I think it goes like the square of the strange mixing angle, and the 10 to the minus 6 is for maximal mixing. So you can get up to 1 if you assume a mixing of 10 to the minus 3. There was this other, so the constraint on the double nucleon decay depends on this scale, lambda tilde, that they construct from something, and there's a lot of uncertainty about what that scale is. So I think that for any given person's theory of how you put a constraint on it, there are different knobs that you can turn that sort of move
right.
It around.
There's clearly SUSY knobs,
but
just going
at three levels,
right?
Yes, that's right. So this is, so the SUSY knob, the dominant SUSY knob would be the strange squark mixing,
right.
But there are other
things
that we don't
know.
So you can get from 10 to the minus.
I'm just trying to figure out what's the actual nuclear physics on the string. Sounds like that's not 10 to the minus 6. Right?
Yeah. I think it's because there are some powers of some nuclear quantity. I don't know.
Okay.
But we can talk about it later. So yeah. So there are some mild bounds on dijet resonances from the fact that you can have, say, in the first case, a U and a D go through a strange squark. So that typically constrains the coupling to be, you know, point something, 0.4, 0.5. So the width of the decay, because it's a three-body decay, it's phase-space suppressed, and it scales like the square of the RPV coupling. And basically, what we find when we plug in different values, even for lambda ranging from 10 to the minus 6 to 1, is that the width is always smaller than lambda QCD by a few orders of magnitude. What this means is that the gluino is going to hadronize before it decays into a color singlet R hadron. It becomes a little bit more dependent whether this happens or not if it's decaying directly to the squark, then it, you know, it depends on what the coupling is a little bit more strongly. But the scenario we're looking at, you know, we choose this parameter space and you get this effect. And in particular, if the coupling is too small, then you can end up with the gluino R hadron traveling some finite distance in your detector and then decaying. And this is also something that we're not particularly interested in, because you could start, for instance, being picked up by B taggers or other things that have displaced vertices. So once again, this makes the model a little bit more visible. But there is this parameter space for the RPV couplings. It's sort of between 10 and the minus 3 and 1, depending on which flavors you're looking at, that don't give you a displaced vertex. So you really just have this six-jet final state. All right. So now we'll talk a little bit about some of the existing searches. So like I said, we have these two three-jet resonances that reconstruct the gluino. So what we can try to do is take our six-jet final state. So there's the Feynman diagram on the left. It looks sort of like this in the detector. At least that's my conception of it on the right. Of course, on the left, it's really easy to group which jets go with which to make the gluino. On the right, it's not. And so we don't actually know which of these jets go with which gluino. And in particular, there are 20 different combinations. So you know, you could say, okay, well, we want both triplets to reconstruct the same mass. Well, in any given event, there's probably some set of triplets that reconstruct the same mass. So that's not really getting you very far. And the same thing is true for QCD. And this is even ignoring things like initial state radiation, other, you know, hard splittings, things like that, which introduce 7, 8 jets. So basically what they found was the only feasible option is, instead of trying to pick out which is the right combination, you literally take every combination of the 6 hardest jets, and then you hope that you can still see some resonance over the large combinatoric background. Now, you can reduce the backgrounds using the fact that if you take jets that aren't coming from a gluino decay and you take their invariant mass, it's going to be correlated with the sum of the PTs of the different jets, because that's what's causing the jet mass, is the kinematics and the opening angle. Whereas if you've picked the correct combination, then the triplet mass is really going to reconstruct the resonance mass. And so what you can do is, and CMS does in this plot on the left, is they plot the invariant mass of the jet triplets versus the sum of the PT. And so the big diagram is the gluino decay, and the small diagram is QCD. So you see that there's this sort of little spike of the signal that juts out. And those are for processes where you produce very high PT jets, but they're still reproducing the invariant mass that's much smaller than that. So you generally expect 3 QCD jets of that to reconstruct a higher mass. They don't. So you're sort of looking for this little bump. And when you make whatever cuts and plot it in a one-dimensional thing versus the invariant mass of the jet triplets, you end up with something that's like this. So your signal-to-background ratio can be quite small, and so you're looking for a very small blip over a falling background. And I mean, this is a fairly challenging thing to do. And it already sort of is suggestive, because we see that the regime where you're actually seeing the gluinos is when they have high PT relative to their mass. So you're already starting to enter into the boosted regime a little bit. So the bounds that you can get from these, the Tevatron did an analysis, and they excluded gluino masses below 145 GeV. And then the CMS analyses have excluded 200 to 460 GeV. So based on these analyses alone, there's actually a gap around the top mass where you can still have a gluino. And basically, it was too high energy for the Tevatron to see and too low energy for LHC to see. Now, just in actually in the same week that our paper came out, Atlas put out a different kind of experiment where they said, instead of trying to reconstruct a resonance, which involves all of these combinatoric issues, let's just do a simple counting experiment where events with gluinos are going to tend to have a lot of very hard jets. QCD jets are going to be sort of in a hierarchy, so you're not really going to have 6 very hard jets. And so they did a really simple thing. They just required 6 jets, R equals 0.4 with PT bigger than some cut, depending on what the mass of the gluino was. And then they estimated their backgrounds by extrapolating the 3-jet distribution to the 4-jet distribution, 4-jet to 5-jet, 5 to 6. And so they were able to get some handle on what they expected. And they were actually able to really surpass all of the existing bounds. They exceeded RBV Clunos up to 666 GeV. It's a fairly inauspicious number, but that's apparently exactly what the bound is. However, these analyses have no sensitivity to what the underlying mass scale is, except indirectly through what the value of the PT cut is. You know, you can kind of vary the PT cut and see how it changes, but you can't really see it. And it is prone, if somehow there was an error made in the extrapolation, then you might get the wrong results here. So we're interested in techniques that can give you this kind of a high mass reach scale, but where you can still get a resonance search, and that is by looking in the boosted regime. And you know, one of the reasons why resonance searches are nice is that they're typically statistics limited, and so basically if you wait long enough, the bump gets bigger, and you can tell whether what you're seeing is real or not. So the question is, can you reproduce or surpass this performance in a completely different way? So as we said, the combinatorial background is a problem. So if you look at when the gluinos are boosted, their decay products tend to line up. And so now we can see exactly, I mean, it doesn't always look this nice in real life, but you have these 3 jets that line up fairly well. And so you can just take the ones that are closest together, clump them together, and you should, in principle, have your gluino. And I should mention that Eder in the fall talked about sort of an intermediate stage where you have these energetic jets, and you can still use jet substructure, but you're sort of capturing, you're basically looking for multiple jets showing up in the same fat jet, but not necessarily reconstructing the same one. So if you go to even higher energies, this is what you see. So the trade-off, of course, is that the boosted fraction is only of order of a few percent, so you're losing a lot of signal. But if, for instance, you know, we have an octet that has a huge production cross-section, we have a lot of signal events to begin with, so we sort of have a lot to play with to begin with. So the first boosted search happened in the same paper as the Atlas County experiment. This was the first search for exotic boosted colored resonances, so it's exciting that they're finally using these ideas, and they've worked really hard to make sure that the data is cross-checking what we're seeing in Monte Carlo. This was also a counting experiment. It wasn't a resonance search. And basically, they were looking for 2 boosted gluinos, which had 3 decays each. The way that they did that is they just looked for a high multiplicity of so-called thin jets, just you know, the normal jets you have in your experiment. And then they clustered those thin jets into fat jets. And then they placed cuts on jet mass and on a jet substructure variable called N sub jettiness, which I'll talk about. And they were able to exclude gluino masses up to 255 GeV, which is low compared to what CMS had done. But it showed that this kind of thing is in principle possible. So this shows that you know these techniques are sensible and that we should try to find ways that we can exploit them so we can do even better than these kinds of bounds. And I should point out that we are not the first people to look at boosted gluino searches in a theoretical study. The first was done by Jay and Gavin and Rocklev. And this was actually done for the Tevatron. And they required 2 boosted gluinos or 2 fat jets. They're comparable in mass and exhibiting some substructure. The actual variable isn't particularly important. It performs comparably to N sub jettiness. So they found that the Tevatron reach was actually very high, so 280 GeV, which on a level doesn't make a lot of sense because it's like, well, how come the LHC bound on boosted stuff wasn't as good as the Tevatron one? It actually turns out because the Tevatron is a PP bar collider, there's a QQ bar initial state that is actually the dominant one. So you have a much larger production cross-section and your boosted fraction is much larger. It's on the order of about 20% as opposed to the LHC where it's only about a few percent.
Why is the production cross-section much larger?
Sorry, I should clarify. If you scale, so let's say that we're interested in scaling the gluino mass with the collider mass. So like a 280 GeV gluino at the Tevatron would be comparable to like a 1 GeV gluino at the LHC.
Why is that?
Just because, I mean, if you scale the center of mass energy. So naively speaking, I mean, the center of mass energy of the LHC is much higher. So the...
Oh, you mean the... I guess I'm confused about the first. You said that somehow it worked in the Tevatron because you have a QQ bar and therefore your cross section, rushing cross section is larger.
Yeah, so for a given ratio of, you know, mass of gluino over root s of the collider, your production cross-section is bigger. I mean, because you could look at this study and say, well, why is everyone futzing around and the best bounds they can get is 250 GeV? They should just do this and they can go up to 1 TeV, no problem. So it turns out that the naive scaling doesn't work between them. And so you actually have to work harder than the relatively mild substructure cuts that they had to use and, you know, basically try harder to extract it. Okay. So what kind of signatures are we going to look for? So there are two sort of gross properties of gluino decay that we exploit. First is the kinematics. So we have the gluino decaying into three collimated jets. So we want to find two fat jets corresponding to the gluinos that reconstruct the same or similar mass. We want each of the fat jet to consist of three hard centers of radiation that correspond to the individual decay product. We also want the PTs of these subjects to be comparable to one another, because when the gluino decays, it tends to be relatively evenly distribute the energy among the final state particles. This is in contrast with QCD, where PTs tend to show up in hierarchy corresponding to emissions. The second is the radiation pattern that you get from gluino decay, which comes from the color structure of the event. And there's a rather unique color structure here, which is that the gluino decays after hadronization. So they form these color singlet R hadrons. And then once the gluinos decay, the decay of the R hadron should still be a color singlet. And so you end up with different kinds of radiation pattern than you would if you just had the decay of some color octet object directly. And I'll talk a little bit more about this. This is still somewhat speculative because, I mean, whenever you're talking about some of these processes, it's really hard to calculate anything. But we argue that it's similar to some other kinds of color connections that have been observed in experiments. So it's, you know, at least not completely crazy. I do want to emphasize, though, that while we think these color flow variables are useful, just the substructure.
It won't be the same as a color singlet, because there is some dipole part.
That's right. But see, the thing is that that dipole will appear in the sort of first round of hadronization when the gluino hadronizes. But the I mean, I'll show you when we get to that, and you can ask me then. So I'll go over some of the substructure variables that we use for each of these things. So for instance, if we want jets to reconstruct the same mass, then we can introduce a jet mass symmetry variable, which basically measures how close are these masses to one another in relative terms. Because we want these jets to be three-pronged, we use a variable called n sub jettiness, which I'll define on the next slide. It won't fit here. And then we want the PT of the three hardest subjects to be comparable. And so what we do is we take the PT of the third hardest subject divided by the PT of the first hardest subject. And for QCD, this tends to be a fairly small number, whereas in signal events, it tends to be fairly large, in the order of 20% or above. And then we introduce some variables that are sensitive to the radiation pattern.
Right.
Yeah? We didn't look at mass drops. So you mean like a mass drop associated with the, like 2 to 3? No, we didn't look at that. I mean, I think it would probably be similar. I mean, one reason why we wanted to use n sub jettiness is because it doesn't require reclustering the jet necessarily. You know, it provides a way of determining what the subjects are, and so it seems a sort of neat, sort of all-inclusive way of doing that. But I mean, do you think that there are, I mean, why do you think that mass drops would have an advantage? Yeah, it might. I mean, my impression from playing around with some of these things is that looking at mass drop versus n sub jettiness versus other things, I mean, they're all sort of latching onto the same physics. And so, I mean, you can get some better or worse kinds of.
By mass drop, you mean take the rare mass of the subject divided by the rare mass of the whole event.
Mm-hmm.
But it runs on with some different kinds
of. So, one sub jettiness is basically the jet mass. It's correlated with the jet mass. I mean, yeah, there are correlations between all of these things, and I don't know. It's it's not obvious to me that one is necessarily better than the other, but I mean, this seems sort of a convenient way, and we use it later. Well, I mean, in principle, this is a jet shape, and so it's as opposed to having to go through the clustering algorithm and then calculate that way. So I would imagine there are fewer iterations associated with it. But that, of course, depends. So n sub j in this, depending on the definition, you might have to go through an iterative process to determine what the jet axes, subjet axes are, and so then you might not save yourself any calculation. Okay, so n sub j in this is a variable that characterizes how much a jet looks like it has n subjets. And so basically it's small if a jet seems well described by n subjects, and it's of order one or big if it doesn't seem to be well described by n subjects. So basically there's a lot of radiation that doesn't happen to be aligned with any of the subjects. So the definition is basically given some number n and a parameter beta, which is a power weighting that shows up in the sum, you basically take n axes, which are determined through some method. Those axes have to lie within your jet, and then you take every particle that's in the jet, you associate it with the closest axis, and you take the pt of that particle times the distance to some power of beta to that axis. So basically the idea is that if all of the radiation, or at least all of the hard radiation, is close to axes, then this number is going to be small. If the radiation is far from the axis, it's going to be big. And this d0 is just a normalization factor. Okay. Now what this parameter beta does is it weights the radiation that's far from the axis in a different way. So if beta is bigger, then soft radiation that's a bit further from where you expect the hard jet centers to be has more influence over where the sum is going to be, and it'll change what the n sub jettiness is. So that's sensitive to what the shape of your radiation pattern is. So how do we figure out which axes to use? Because the axes are somewhat correlated with subjects, the original way of finding the axes is something that Atlas still uses, where you use KT clustering to recluster into exactly n subjects, and then you just take the directions of those subjects and throw that into your sum. And one disadvantage of this is that you can get what seem to be unphysical values of n sub jettiness. Like, there can be somewhat weird behavior, but overall it behaves pretty well. However, you could say that n sub jettiness is in a way telling you what axes you should be using, because it's some metric and it tells you how well these axes are aligned with radiation, and there's going to be a global minimum associated with the best choice of axes. And for a particular choice of the parameter beta, that will give you tell you what your subjects should be. Of course, this isn't a question with a unique answer, because it really depends on what it is that you're looking at. But in general, this is something that they've implemented a fairly fast algorithm for that's based on solving an equivalent problem that someone has devised an algorithm for doing. And it tends to give you n sub jettiness distributions that are a bit more peaked. So the signal and background tend to be peaked in different places, more so than if you're using the KT choice, just because your axes aren't really the best that they can be in some sense. So we use the minimization technique, which is outlined in this paper that Jesse Thaler wrote with Ken Van Tilburg. And we found at least that there seemed to be a substantial improvement over KT clustering. I've talked to some experimentalists about ways that they should think about implementing this as well. So it turns out it's actually better when using n sub jettiness to look at ratios of n sub jettiness. The reason is that the actual overall value of tau n doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot, but if, let's say, you go from n equals 2 to n equals 3 and there's a sudden drop in n sub jettiness, then it means that all of a sudden your axes have locked onto a certain number of subjects. So it indicates probably, in this case, 3 would be a good choice of axes, whereas 2 wasn't. So there's some schematic picture of this where, let's say, we have two jets here. One of them has what appear to be obviously two subjects. One doesn't really look like two subjects. It looks like one jet with just some emission somewhere. And so the cross is where your one sub jettiness axis would be. And we see that in both cases, it picks out the center of the jet, so it's not particularly surprising. In the left case, n sub jettiness is going to be big, in the right case, it's going to be small, because most of the radiation is aligned with it. But once you go to two axes, which are represented by the dots, you see that in the left case, you get a real drop in n sub jettiness, because now that you've really picked out the two subjects, whereas on the right, it doesn't really change very much. So this is from Jesse Taylor's original paper, but they look, for instance, in tau 2 over tau 1 for comparing W jets versus QCD jets, and you see that there is this pretty nice separation between the two of them. And it's not something, so on the right, you just see the absolute values. It's not something that you can really replicate by just making a cut on some value at the end, you know, either the one subjettiness or the two subjettiness. So in our analysis, we use tau 3 over 2 because we're looking for three-prong decays. Okay, so now let's look at the color flow. So the intuition behind this is, let's say that we have a pair of quarks that arise from the decay of a color singlet particle. They form a color dipole. And the radiation tends to be concentrated between the two particles and the dipole. And intuitively, it's just because if you're far away from the dipole, it looks like a singlet, and so you don't get much radiation. And so particularly in the case of QCD, you get this flux tube that connects the two of them. So you have this color string picture where you imagine these two quarks connected by a color string. And then at the time of hadronization, that string sort of fragments, and the hadrons form along that string. And so you end up with, you know, the two large centers of radiation associated with the two jets. And then instead of them being these circular jets, you actually have kind of an excess of particles in between and less on the outside. So this is what you get, for instance, if you have a hadronic W or you have a Higgs decaying into hadronic final states. So here you have the incoming beams and you end up with the two outgoing jets connected to one another. And this is something that's been observed in a number of different experimental contexts. However, in a proton collider, when you have a collision, you're sort of ejecting a quark from each beam. And so what the proton used to be is now also a colored object. And so it is going to form a color dipole, or as the distances get bigger, the strong coupling gets even stronger, and you need to have it form a singlet with something. So in this particular instance, you could have two protons coming in, and let's say going through a gluon into two final state quarks. What you find is that the final state quarks, rather than being connected to one another, are actually connected to the beams. And so what you find is that they seem to exhibit a dipole radiation pattern, but a dipole radiation pattern directed towards the beam, not towards one another. And the physical picture is a little bit less clear because the beam remnant is actually some collection of quarks and gluons flying around. And so you don't really have simple dipoles. But it seems, at least in where experiments have looked at this, for instance, they've looked at W plus single jet events at the Tevatron, and they found that you have the W around here, so they isolate the region around the W boson, and then the jet. And let's say this is... Oh, sorry. Should I... Oh, okay. Can't see.
Yeah, maybe a little over to the right.
Okay. Okay. I'll make it bigger too. So let's say this is eta and phi going from minus infinity to positive infinity on the eta direction. So let's say we have our W, we have our jet. So they use this leptonic W to. I think it was leptonic W. But anyway, they were using cone jets at the time, basically draw a circle around both the locations of these things. And this shouldn't have any color connections to anything. And so what they did was they sort of looked at this annular region on the outside. So this shouldn't have any excess radiation point in any direction. It should just basically be a circular thing. And so what they found then they took whatever this radiation pattern was here and used it to normalize the radiation they were finding around the jet to subtract off things like pile up and whatnot. They found that there was an excess of radiation in the jet pointing in the direction of the two beams, which is consistent with you have QQ bar, W, gluon, then the color lines are such that this jet is going to be color connected to both beams. And the radiation pattern you get is similar to what you get from a dipole. So what's interesting about this is that even though there's not really a clear perturbative way of understanding it in the same way that you would for a color dipole, the basic picture remains the same. You have some overall color structure, and even though the proton consists of some mess of things, sort of on the whole, it has some overall charge that leads to some radiation pattern between it and the jet or whatever it is that you're looking at. So in our scenario, we have a gluino that decays after it hadronizes. And so the gluino decay results in three hard quarks and then whatever the remnants of the hadron were originally. So this is kind of similar to the beam remnant in that, okay, it's not traveling at 70 eV or whatever, but you do have this collection of quarks and gluons inside of the particle, and then you have these three hard partons coming out of it. And in order, so this whole system is a color singlet, and you're going to end up with dipole radiation-like radiation happening in the inner region. Now, it's not possible to say, okay, it's going to look exactly like a combination of three dipoles, because it's a much more complicated radiation pattern than that. But you are generally going to expect an excess of radiation between the outgoing jets or subjets and wherever the R hadron was, because that was sort of where they were all connected to. So. To some extent, I don't think it's huge though, because when the relevant time scale is going to be as the outgoing quarks from the gluino decay are, you know, order 1/lambda QCD from the center, at which point it's still going to be sensitive to whatever color stuff happens to be in the hadron at that particular point in time. So I think that it's less important, you know, oh, this quark happens to be, so like, I think what you're saying is that in this case, let's say you have an R baryon here, and you have your gluino inside of it bound to three quarks. You know, that's sort of an oversimplification of what's actually going inside of the hadron. So to first order, yeah, it might look like this, but there are also lots of other colored stuff that you have to, you know, reconnect or that you have to turn into a singlet. And so I don't think that you're necessarily going to have preferential radiation between like these two quarks because they happen to be color connected to the same thing inside the hadron. Does that answer your question, or? Yeah, yeah. So I mean, I think that what we're going here is sort of like gross picture, where the main important thing is that you have some, so when the gluino hadronizes, you do have some color connection to the beam or to other things, the final state, but that's really going to be happening sort of wherever the center of the jet is, where the gluino R hadron was originally. Then it's going to decay into three further jets. And that system that's decaying is a singlet. And so you're not going to end up with a lot of radiation on the outside of it. It's really going to be concentrated sort of on the inside.
Well, so this is that physical picture I'm not sure I believe. Because in the case of a singlet decaying, it's clear why it's happening, right? As you said, that you know, they basically come out and they have to connect among themselves.
Yeah.
Here they don't have to do that, right? Because they can pick up one of the valence quarks and just form singlet with it.
Yeah.
And the other one can pick the other valence quark and form singlet with it. And so there is no obvious reason why those two should be have radiation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a possibility. But at the same time, I think that that relies on an understanding of the hadron of, you know, you have that. All they're seeing is the valence quark, but they're not going to just be seeing that because they're really close to the mess of what's going on there. And I mean, and it's similar to color connection of the proton beam in that sense, that you could say, oh, well, one of them is just connected to, you know, one of the particles in the proton pulls it out or something. I don't know.
So you're saying the fact that we're seeing it in the proton beam.
Yeah. This, which effect? This one? So this has not been observed because we've never seen an R hadron or anything like that. So, but the W case has been observed. And for instance, they've looked, so recently the Tevatron did a study of pull, which I'll talk about in a moment, but the idea was trying to separate BB bar from Higgs versus BB bar from QCD. And the QCD ones are going to be connected to the beam, and the Higgs ones are going to be color connected to one another. And they did a study that they were sort of using the W in a top quark as sort of a test thing. So, you know, the two quarks coming from hadronic W versus the Bs from the tops. And they, again, I mean, this stuff is hard to look for, but it seems consistent with the picture anyway. But yeah. Pardon me? I don't know. That's actually a good point. I mean, I don't know if the B is heavy enough, but yeah, I should look into that and see what kinds of things people are talking about for that. So this is something that, once again, we haven't measured. It's somewhat speculative, but I think part of what we wanted to show is that this kind of radiation pattern, because it's fairly distinctive from QCD, which tends to be connected to pretty much everything else in the event, by constructing certain variables, if this was, you know, in fact the correct picture, and there's some reasons to believe that it is, then it could be a powerful discriminant. And I think it really motivates looking at the QCD shapes for these things. And maybe not the variables we're talking about specifically, but that it is actually something that could be useful. So. Pretty well, actually, yeah. So they're, the people at the Tevatron, I think they compared Pythia 6, Pythia 8, and Herwig. I'm not entirely sure. Or maybe it was Alpgen plus Herwig and Pythia. They had sort of a whole combination of different Monte Carlos. And I mean, there were differences among them, but the general features were very much the same. But I mean, the hope is that by studying standard model processes, and if you can tune the Monte Carlos to observables there, that then you're getting a better picture of what's going on. But to some extent, you know, this at worst can be treated as an ansatz for, you know, this is the kind of color structure you would get from an event like this. And I think that the general features are true. The exactly how it forms is not understood. And I mean, Pythia and all of these things are kind of hacked to do this, but it sort of shows you what you could potentially do. But I agree that this all needs to be studied much better and more than we were doing. And it is something we're interested in following up on. So, okay, we look at, it's getting late, okay. Two variables that I will talk about. I might not even talk about the second one, but. So these are trying to extract the pattern, the radiation pattern that we were just talking about. And so we've seen that radiation from color flow tends to make jets lopsided instead of round. And Matt Schwartz and Jason Galicchio proposed a variable that characterizes this, and it's something called the pull vector. And it's basically this sum, where you take each particle in the jet, you take the weight by pt and the distance squared from the center of the jet. And it's basically telling you, you know, if you have more radiation that's further away, that's going to contribute more to the pull vector, and you're going to get pull in the direction of where you have these sort of extra lobes. So for instance, if you have this dipole pattern, then the pull is going to point in the direction of the extra radiation. And one way that you can tell that something is a color singlet is that the two vectors should pull towards one another. So for instance, this is all Monte Carlo, but they took an example where you have ZH production where H goes to BB bar, and you just compare it to BB bar production in the background. And so they found that, for instance, the background ones tend to be connected to high and low rapidity, whereas the signal events tend to be connected to one another. Now, one thing that I should say that isn't really well understood is if you have something like this, so here it just so happens that the background jets are color connected to the closest beam. There's not necessarily a reason for that, and there's the possibility of these color reconnections that basically say, okay, well, things are actually being color connected in such a way to minimize the total potential energy at the time of hadronization, in which case the distance that things are in actual real space becomes important. There have been some studies, though, that show that if you add in these tunes into Pythia where you can change the color reconnection parameters, that it's actually a best fit when those color reconnections are small. So I think that in principle, it could be connected to either beam, but anyway, so this is a picture that's sort of a general one. And so by looking at, for instance, the angles of the pull vectors in the eta phi space, you can have some handle for discrimination. So for an R-single, there's really this overall color singlet picture. And so generally the poles are going to be inward. And there can also be color connections between the two other jets, but in general those tend to either cancel each other out or if anything point inwards. So the key thing is that there's an absence in the subjets of an outward connection to the beams. So what we did was we introduced a variable which we called radial pole, which is basically you construct the pole vectors for each of the subjets. So instead of looking at the global event topology, you're only looking within a single jet, and you basically project it onto the line that connects the subject to where the gluino was, and you say, that's the region where you expect the radiation to be, at least enclosed within this circle. And I mean, there are reasons why we weren't particularly, or we didn't find useful observables that sort of drew a circle and counted the radiation inside versus outside, because there's a whole lot of other factors in that that are problematic, and often they overlap with the subjects. So we found this to be a good characterization of this, and it's something that we saw distinguishing between signal and background. So this is before we've really done any serious cuts. Basically, we've imposed trigger cuts, required two fat jets with some TT, and imposed some mild and subgenous cut. So you see that there isn't a huge amount of discrimination, largely because there is a lot of other stuff going on in the event, and so it's kind of a messy thing. What we find is that particularly if you look at sort of where the pole is inward, you see a pretty sharp drop off of the background. And so this is a scenario where if, for instance, you had a gluino that was 200 GeV and you had a huge number of events, then you know QCD almost never just randomly gives you radiation patterns where everything is directed towards the center of the jet and that exhibits this kind of structure. So you can actually have a significant gain by using something like this. Now there was another variable that basically measures the same thing, which it's based on N sub J-ness, and one reason why we wanted this is that it doesn't involve jet clustering. It's just based on the minimization technique in N sub J-ness, and it's something that works well if these subjects overlap, because I mean they're not always going to look like this ideal scenario. But for our intents and purposes, we can skip that because I don't want to go too far over time. You can ask me about it later if you're interested. Okay, so for the Monte Carlo, we consider two different regimes which correspond to the two unconstrained regions of gluino parameter space until the day before we put our paper out. And then the Atlas analysis excluded a whole bunch of it. But we considered heavy gluinos, which are at the CMS bound and above. And we want to see how high can you go in these boosted searches. And then we looked around the top mass, first of all, in order to close this gap, but also because in this region, you would expect gluinos to be highly boosted. And so in some sense, it's kind of a playground of what you could potentially do if you had a signal. And one of the things that we show is that you can, particularly with the combination of substructure and color flow observables, really isolate out the signal events. So in the hopeful event one day that we see something, then these techniques might be really useful. So we generated signal events in what was then a developmental version of Pythia 8, which has now been released publicly, which includes both gluino hadronization and decay. Again, you know, there's some details of it that you may not want to trust, but it at least gives us some idea of what might be expected. We calculated the cross sections using Prospino, and all the backgrounds we did in Sherpa, we looked at both QCD and TT bar backgrounds. And generally, we found the QCD were more important. Okay, so we used FastJet with the N sub J-ness plugin. We wanted to make sure that what we were doing was sensible, so we validated against Atlas data. And so on the left, we see a jet mass distribution for jets in a certain bin. And on the right, we see Sherpa compared with the N sub J-ness ratio, tau 3 over tau 2. So jet mass distribution, you know, it peaks a little bit in the wrong place, but if anything, it shows that Sherpa is a little bit overly conservative at higher masses.
Did you look at it?
Yes, we did. So this is compared to data, so there's no trimming here. And I mean, what's remarkable is that the N sub J-ness really matches very well. But I guess where it's going with, so this is using the KT algorithm rather than the axis minimization. And so generally, you'd expect that going from N sub J-ness to N plus 1 sub J-ness, you should always find a drop in the value because you're adding an additional axis, so it should do better. We see here the effects of the using KT algorithm. You actually have something where the ratio is bigger than one sometimes. which just is an artifact of the jet clustering. So I think that's one nice reason to use the minimization technique. That's right. So this is Atlas 7 TeV 35 in this particular. Yes. I mean, there are error bars on the data which aren't on this, but I mean, it. So in some sense, it's a fluke, but I mean, it matches it really well. This is where the me being shifty comes into it, right? We didn't explicitly include pileup. There are pileup mitigation techniques, and so we checked that applying jet grooming algorithms didn't affect the overall outcome. So for instance, in our trimmed data set, we didn't have as high statistics. We wanted to see if we could replicate what we were doing. So a lot of the plots I've showed is not using the trimmed data. But basically, we found that if you applied trimming, all of the distributions shifted around, but you could essentially pick similar values of cuts that, you know, were off numerically from what they were before and get the same overall efficiency. And you got the same results in terms of the resonance surge. The values of, so for those who don't know, trimming is basically you take the jet, which consists of some hard parts and a bunch of soft stuff that largely comes from pileup or you know, other interactions going on. You recluster it into subjets, and then you require that the subjets constitute some fraction of the jet, so you know, 3% or 5%. And the goal is that what you want to try to do is get rid of the large areas of soft stuff that don't contribute a whole lot to the overall jet PT, but if you included all of them, it would start skewing the distributions of your jet observables. The values of the trimming that we picked were consistent with, we looked up some numbers for if you have 20 primary vertex pileup, what's the average and standard deviation of the fluctuations, and then we sort of multiplied it by 3, say, and required that the trimming was enough to get rid of those. So the trimming is a little bit softer than what Atlas has looked at, but part of the reason is that if you trim too aggressively, then particularly for n-subjettiness, you get rid of some of the features that allow you to distinguish the signal from the background. If you trim really aggressively, you end up with 3 jets and nothing else, and so then you get a tau 3/2 of 0 for both of them, basically. Now the color flow variables, unfortunately, do depend on a lot of the soft radiation that would be thrown away from trimming. So this can be mitigated, for instance, by using only particles that are within a certain distance of whatever your subjet is, so that at least you're not getting much of the pileup. The characteristic scale of this radiation is a little bit harder than what you expect from pileup, but this is something that we're currently looking into. We're actually going to simulate the pileup and see if you can still see these effects, or if they really throw things off. And then there's a new paper which we're interested in looking at, which proposes a subtraction method that is basically based on a particular jet shape. You sort of calculate how pileup affects that jet shape, and it could, in principle, be used for some of the things we're looking at. I agree. And I mean, currently we are trying to do comparisons with other Monte Carlos in the background. So Powhike plus Pythia, which is what the experimentalists did. So I think the trimming will become more important there. I think part of the thing was we got basically the same result when we did it this, you know, with and without, which means that at least for the particular background we're looking at with Sherpa, the variables we were using were somewhat robust. If we did the same thing using a different data set, that probably wouldn't be true. So then for a good comparison, you need to trim. But I mean, you know, we were producing similar plots. They look like the plots that I'm about to show you, but the statistical error bars were much bigger just because we had limited resources. And we wanted to get this out while the Atlas result was fresh in people's minds and people were thinking about it. Okay. So the triggers that we use an HT trigger for the case of the heavy jets, which was sort of a simple thing to come up with because you just end up with a large amount of hadronic activity, and basically there's 100% efficiency for passing the trigger. But the top mass, it was harder, and part of the reason why the top mass galenos weren't excluded is precisely because they're sort of too low energy, there's a lot of top backgrounds, it was hard for CMS to push their bound low enough. So we ended up using a six jet trigger with all six jets with PT bigger than 60 GeV. And this is a pretty aggressive trigger. They're very low efficiencies for both signal and background. But because of the large production cross-section, we were able to get enough statistics. Okay. So we looked at two fat jets. We optimized the PT cut to the fat jets based on what the gluino mass was. We had an N sub J and a tau 3-2 cut less than 0.5. We required that the jets have comparable mass to within 10%. And we required that the PT of the third jet ratio with the PT of the first jet be larger than a particular value. And then we cut on these variables. So we, we chose to look at the 20 inverse sum-to-barn data set. So the initial sample that we looked at, we just put the jet mass and some basic N sub J-ness cut on so that we had some manageable amount of data that we could store and then do the rest of our analyses on. So this is the picture that you get. There are four different colors that we used to code up the signal versus the background in some sense. So green are the QCD events. Blue or cyan are the top events. And then there are the gluino events. The burgundy ones are ones where we compared with the Monte Carlo and we said, okay, the gluino is within an R of 0.3 of where the fat jet center is. So that, you know, this fat jet that we found is actually the gluino. The yellow background is combinatoric background where, okay, you have these fat jets that satisfy the conditions, but they're not because the gluinos are being accurately reconstructed. It's just because, you know, crap is everywhere and you just happen to do that. So this is sort of what you're up against, which is that you see some huge amount of QCD background, you can't even really see the signal. So we apply succession of the cuts that we were looking at. So for instance, the N sub jettiness cut, the jet mass symmetry cut. These are all normalized so that the, is that true? Yeah, they must be normalized. Yeah, so number over number total. So that you get a sense of the shape of them. And so basically, we're exploiting all of these different kinematic properties in order to isolate the sample that looks most like the gluinos. And when we're done with this, we end up with something that looks kind of like this, which is basically a background and then a resonance peak that you see over that background. So what's nice about this is, once again, because it's a resonance, this isn't something that will just come about because of basically the chance of this happening as a fluke is quite low, and obviously you can quantify that. But it's nice that you can sort of cut down on these backgrounds by examining all these variables in such a way that even though you had relatively few signal events, you can still do something with it. And then we did a cut on one of our color variables that is the analogy of radial pole, but using N sub J-ness axes, and you see that even then, you can basically, without getting rid of any signal events, clean it up so that you really get this sort of background lump plus a big peak over it. What do you mean? Yeah, but I mean, there's still a big bump there. Whether you color it red or... Sorry, these are stacked on top. No. No, we're just saying that there's a big bump where you otherwise wouldn't see a bump. So what we're trying to show here is that all of these cuts are getting rid of the gluino decays that aren't associated with being correctly clustered as well. And that sort of informed what we were doing. Because otherwise, what you could do is you could pick cuts such that, okay, you have a fairly large signal in the background, but basically the signal in the background look exactly the same, and you wouldn't believe it. Yeah. So part of it is that that was before we did some of the substructure cuts. So it turns out that in particular, the I think the jet PT hierarchy cut is important because basically what we were showing before was just die jets that happen to have a little bit of structure in them. And so there, if you have a lot of radiation concentrated towards the center, then it can do that. I mean, here, granted, I mean, we don't have a lot of statistics to begin with. What we've shown is that you can kind of, by taking a little cut of the signal and a little cut of the background, you can sort of clean things up a little bit. So that, you know, they have these uses. It turns out not to really help you in terms of exclusion when you're just looking at the statistics, but you know, we weren't really trying to estimate the uncertainties of, you know, modeling the background and whatnot. The one up top, you might say, okay, if the peak fluctuates down and the left thing fluctuates up, you know, do you really trust what you're seeing? Whereas here, you're really seeing a bump, which is offset from the edge associated with the background. So then we did a shape analysis where we fit a resonance to it, and we compared it to a background that was, you know, of this shape. And so we have these Brazil plots. We show that with the color cuts, without the color cuts, you can basically rule out gluiness up to about 750 GeV with 20 inverse femtobarns. Barnes. Not shown here, but 650 GeV with 8 in. Sorry, with 5 inverse femtobarns. So the moral of the story is, you, even though you know, you've cut away a lot of your signal, you're basically getting a comparable reach to what you were getting with the resolved analysis. And the thing about the resolved analysis is because it's statistics limited, systematics limited, there's only so high you can push it. And it seems like they're probably not going to get much higher than 750 GeV, even with the inclusion of the 20 inverse femtobarn data set. So it didn't help in the shape analysis we were doing, really, because, I mean, really what this comes down to is you're seeing the resonance, and what's really relevant is the background in the bins with the resonance in it that's driving the statistical analysis. All I'm saying is that we weren't trying to account for the subtleties associated with trying to model the background, and that if you looked at, I mean, just sort of naively, if you looked at this background, you might say, well, are you really seeing a bump? You know, particularly when you're dealing with an expectation value of 20 events, okay, well, maybe, you know, seeing 15 or 12 isn't that out of the question, and then you wouldn't see it at all. So, but the background on resonance doesn't really seem to change a whole lot. So, anyway, sorry that I've gone sort of over, but okay. So then I'll just quickly zip through essentially the same plots with the top mass gluino here, because the production cross section is larger. Even before you do a lot of the cuts, you see, you know, you have a lot of signal events to be working on. And this is basically the counting experiment that they've done, was just looking at this without looking for a peak. But we showed that you can still extract the peak, even though the peak happens to sort of coincide with this other mess that's going on. So we apply cuts on the similar variables, and we basically end up with something that looks like this. And this is before we apply any color cuts. But I mean, your signal to background is in the order of 2 to 3. So you have a fairly significant handle on the new physics. And I mean, there's like 1,000 events here. So I mean, there's a lot of other things that you can do with it. And so one thing that we looked at is that if you look at a cut on radial pull, and we basically do the hardest possible cut that you can make, then you can essentially eliminate your background. Now, I don't know if I really believe that you can really eliminate your background. But the moral of the story is that with this amount of data, you could, in principle, you know, if you've studied the color flow of QCD jets, you know, there is this fall off towards the lower end. And so you can end up with signal to background that is much larger and essentially a pure sample of signal events. So we found that Atlas, they already rule out 175 GeV gluino. In fact, they rule out, we can talk about it in terms of constraints on cross-section times branching ratio. They can rule out a branching ratio of 0.25. Our analysis would, at 5 inverse femtobarn, rule out 0.15, and you could go a factor of 5 lower. So there are, in principle, improvements that could be made. So basically, we've shown that it's very severe cuts, and looking at color flow can be helpful in isolating pure samples of gluinos. So we've shown that boosted searches provide a complementary way to search for all hadronic final states that can have comparable reach, that have different kinds of issues in the experimental analysis, and so can be seen as a complementary check on them with higher signal background, and it can be a good way to tag new physics events. We've seen that color flow observables can be powerful, but the most important thing is that there needs to be both a better theoretical understanding and experimental study of pure QCD events for the kinds of variables we were looking at. And there's a lot of ways that you could use this in future work. For instance, if you have gluinos decaying to 2 quarks plus a neutralino, and a neutralino decaying through an R-parity violating vertex, that would give you a very large quantity of boosted hadronic final states. Maybe some challenging to look for Higgs states have interesting color structure that could be studied. So thank you.
We have a lot of questions and we're over time. Maybe one or two later. So let's just thank Brian again.